The story goes that an Eastern potentate asked his wise men to come up with a thought that would prove true in every circumstance at all times. After consulting with one another, the wise men returned to the king with these words, "This too shall pass." Everything in this world changes, and yet at the same time, everything seems to remain the same. That observation is hardly new. In fact, between about 625 BC and 450 BC, the question of the nature of reality and the nature of motion and change were the primary focus of the great thinkers of that era, thinkers we today call the pre-Socratic philosophers. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, your host for Wyoming Catholic College's After Dinner Scholar podcast. This week, I'm joined by Dr. Michael Bolin, Assistant Professor of Theology and Philosophy, who has been teaching the pre-Socratics to our freshmen here at Wyoming Catholic College. Welcome, Dr. Bolin. Now, you were very keen on doing a podcast about the pre-Socratic philosophers. Why is that? What about them grabs your interest and your imagination?
Well, their sayings are very striking. That's the very first thing that's grabbing. One of them, the pre-Socratic philosopher Heraclitus, has sayings that sound almost, dare I say, Confucian. He says, for example, the way up and the way down are one and the same, or the sun is new every day. And these sayings are very striking, and you wonder what's going on. But another thing is that they're really the beginning of philosophy historically. They're not famous in the way that Aristotle or Plato or Socrates are. In fact, the collective title pre-Socratics you might think is kind of demeaning. They're the guys before Socrates, the unimportant guys. But Aristotle himself, in his work Nicomachean Ethics, he quotes an ancient saying, "The beginning is more than half of the whole." And it seems to be true. Making a good beginning is essential, even if by its own lights, the beginning doesn't get very far. If you want to begin an exercise regime, you've got to start somewhere. If you don't make the first day, you'll never get anywhere. Even though by itself, a day of exercise is not going to make you fit. And so there would have been no Aristotle if there weren't a Plato, and no Plato with no Socrates. And really, there's no pre-Socratics, no Socrates. So they're the beginning, and the importance of the beginning is judged not by itself, but by what is the beginning of. So it's really the beginning of philosophy. Mm-hmm. One more observation on that point. The mathematician and philosopher Alfred Whitehead is famous for saying that all of philosophy is a series of footnotes to Plato. Well, we might add to that and go further and say, well, Plato was a series of footnotes to the pre-Socratics. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, give us some background. Who were they? What were they? When were they? Where were they from?
Right. They're primarily from, we think of them as ancient Greeks. Many of them were from ancient Greece. A number are also from Ionia, which is the western side of modern-day Turkey. A few were from Sicily in Italy. So they're from that region, the Mediterranean region. And most of them lived in the 6th and 5th centuries BC. The very first recorded philosopher, Thales from Miletus in modern-day Turkey, was very late 7th century, early 6th century BC. And contrasted, all of them really, but Thales first of all, contrasted themselves with the Greek poets. So before them, we had Homer and Hesiod, who of course are the famous Greek poets. And Hesiod writes about the origin of the world as the origin of the gods Gaia, the earth, and Uranus, the heavens, and so on. And his nature, as it's presented by Hesiod, is really, it's really the same thing as divinity. It's shot through with these divine characteristics. And it seems that the reasons are maybe somewhat lost to history, but at some point, some of the earliest Greek philosophers decided that it's not good enough to just make everything divine. We look at the world around us, there's nature is out there, it's a reality. There are human beings and they do one thing in Egypt, they didn't do another thing in Greece, and we can see that by talking to sailors and so forth, and they learn about what's going on in the world. And I think they realized that human custom differs from place to place, but human beings, they're still the same. there really is this underlying nature of things, and can we understand that apart from divinity? And so they're often, the first philosophers are sort of often contrasted with the mythologies of ancient Greece that we get from Hesiod. And so they're viewed as kind of rationalists. Mm-hmm. In certain circles today, that might be taken as a kind of apologia for atheism. These are the first guys to see that religion is all bosh. That's not really true, generically. It is true that they rejected the many of the details of the Greek mythologies. Socrates tells us that one of the reasons he was accused of atheism is because he found it impossible to believe in the gods of Homer. But what he meant by that, if you read that in more detail, is that the gods in Homer are really superhuman beings with all the human vices. They commit adultery, they lie, they do all these other things. And Socrates didn't think that could possibly be a characteristic of divinity, and so he rejected that. But it doesn't seem legitimate to me to make the leap to conclude that they were modern-day atheists. That mm-hmm. doesn't seem true.
Yeah, I noticed Xenophanes said that Homer and Hesiod attributed to the gods all things which are disreputable and worthy of blame when done by men. So
that's right, you know, right.
They're taking obviously a real turn from that kind of thinking.
Right, and half the Greek mythology is the story starts out because with Zeus chasing another god's wife or something, another human woman, right? Mm-hmm. So very very human faults and not really marks of true divinity. So I think in that respect, the early philosophers were quite right to say this is not the reality of divinity, and therefore maybe it's not what they say about nature is not real either. Let's actually, maybe we should look at the world around us and ask what we can learn from it. And there was you mentioned Xenophanes, who's also from Ionia, and in another one of his fragments, he points out that we can't assume that we know everything by divine revelation. Sometimes we just have to go out and look at the world and try to figure it out for ourselves.
I noticed that a number of them talked about how we have to figure this out. We need the logos. Mm-hmm. We need to reason this out.
Right. Oh. If I might add one point there, I mentioned one of the fragments. We don't have any complete extant writings from the pre-Socratic philosophers. All we have primarily are short snippets, sayings that were written down or recorded by other authors later, such as Aristotle. Many of our sayings from the pre-Socratics come from Aristotle. And so we call them the fragments, so we have no complete works.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, now, looking at Heraclitus's famous aphorism, is it or is it not possible to step into the same river twice? And why was that an important consideration for these folks and perhaps for us as well?
Oh, that's a good question. It's a very, maybe the most famous saying of Heraclitus, you cannot step twice in the same river. And the idea there is that Heraclitus was very taken with the notion of change. So one of his predecessors, Thales, the first recorded philosopher, said that everything comes from water. And there's something to be said for that. If you live on an island and the earth seems to be surrounded by water and you see that life depends on water. But Heraclitus noticed that it's not just that we take in water, we depend on water, but there's a lot of, the natural world is alive, it's always changing. And so he became very interested in asking, what's the cause of change? So for instance, he focuses on fire as the fundamental element, perhaps because it seems the most intrinsically active if you watch fire compared to earth or water or air. And so with his interest in change, he became focused on this idea that the world as we know it is always in a state of flux. There's no permanence. And so the river is always flowing. You step into it one moment, next moment it's a different river. It's flowed downstream. And so I suppose in that sense, he was right. You can't step twice in the same river. One of Heraclitus' disciples, Cratylus, apparently took this to an extreme and ended up saying you can't step in the same river once. The idea there was, well, stepping takes time. During that time, the river is flowing by you.
Right.
And Aristotle sort of pokes a little bit of fun at Cratylus and says that eventually Cratylus refused to say anything but would only move his finger. He would only point. The idea being, I think, if you say anything, you're implying that there's some kind of stability. This is the way it is, but if it's always changing, there is no way it is. We can't say anything. And so Aristotle sort of makes fun of him for that. But But the idea is somewhat sound, that one of the most striking things about nature is that the natural world is alive and always changing. And to that extent, I think Heraclitus had a good insight there.
Now, there are other philosophers that say that there really is nothing is changing. Things only appear to be changing among this same group of philosophers.
That's right. One of the particular schools of the pre-Socratic philosophers, they're known as the Eleatic philosophers, Parmenides, Melissus, and Zeno. Zeno is perhaps the most famous. They looked at their predecessors who were asking, where does everything come from? Does everything come from water or earth or what? And they said, well, the question is all wrong. Maybe things don't come from anywhere, because coming to be is impossible. Now, that might seem odd if you just look at the world around you, but they did have an argument. And the idea was this. Parmenides would say, well, look, if, say, a new thing, a new oak tree can come to be, where did it come from? Did it exist before? And if not, well, everyone seems to agree that nothing can come from nothing. So how is coming to be possible? And he said, well, look, you can rely on your senses and say it looks like things come to be, but maybe reason is more trustworthy. And so if we have an argument that seems to show that change is impossible, you can't get something out of nothing, and so there can never be anything new, I'm going to go with that over my senses. That might ultimately be flawed, but it does show that they had an interest in following the argument and seeing where reason could lead us. Aristotle takes quite a bit of time, actually, in his book Physics, unpacking the problem of change, how it's possible for things to change and for new things to come to be without just saying something can come from nothing, which pretty much all these philosophers agreed on. Some of the later ones, in fact, their thought seems to be focused on the question, well, given that Parmenides had to be partly right, at least, it's impossible for something to come from nothing, why does it look like things come to be? Mm-hmm. And so, for example, the last pre-Socratic philosopher is Democritus of the atomist school. He's famous for saying everything's made of atoms. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's especially striking to students because that's what they learned in school. Everything's made of atoms. And so he seems kind of modern. But what Democritus was doing was saying the things that really exist, the fundamental entities, they have to be eternal. They can't be generated or corrupted for the reasons that Parmenides said. You can't get something from nothing. And so the appearance of change is really just the rearranging of these pre-existent atoms which exist eternally. And so it was an attempt to reconcile the arguments against change with the apparent fact of change, which we all observe. Perhaps the most famous in that school is the philosopher Zeno, who's known for his arguments against the possibility of motion. One famous argument Zeno gives, he says, imagine you're standing in a room and you want to walk to the other wall. Well, to reach the other wall, you have to first reach the halfway point between where you started and the wall.
Right.
But to reach the halfway point, you've got to get halfway there, and so on forever. And so Zeno says, well, motion must be impossible because you could never make the first step. It's clever, maybe ultimately wrong, but it's clever.
So. Yeah. Now, some of their ideas, well, is it fair to say that some of their ideas are still with us? I mean, I noticed Xenophanes, there was a reference to reincarnation, the dog that had somebody else's soul. There's a lot of the everything is one that we see in the Eastern thought and in what we call the New Age and the generally Gnostic flavor of our culture. Would you comment on the relevance of reading these folks today?
Sure. Yes, I think that's true in what you called the New Age philosophy. You see some of those ideas. But perhaps more interestingly, you might say they're also with us in the scientific sense. Mm. These are the first recorded philosophers, and the questions they're asking are, where does everything come from? How do things come to be? And the way they interpret that question at first is to ask, what's sort of the fundamental matter that everything comes from? And they take that to be the ultimate explanation of everything. Well, if you go to any physics department in a major university today, what you're going to find are physicists who take the ultimate explanation of things to be the matter they come from, and that's the end of the story. And so that sort of fundamental idea of what it means to explain things is still with us, not only in the New Age sense, but even in the hard sciences. You still see some of the same ideas. And that kind of indicates, I think, that it's not chance that the pre-Socratics began where they did, but that's kind of where human reason naturally begins when it starts to ask about the causes of everything. And so we as a culture, we don't teach much philosophy anymore. We don't learn it, but it's a human thing to do. And so whatever discipline we're in, if we're in physics or biology or what have you, we still tend to be philosophers in our odd moments. And so if we've never been taught any philosophy, we've never studied it, we tend to begin where it's natural to begin. And so I think it's not a coincidence that we have all these modern day scientists who, philosophically speaking, they're kind of pre-Socratics. And that sort of gets to the other part of your question, because it sort of shows us one reason why it's important to study these philosophers, right? One can't skip the beginning, right? We can't learn calculus until we've learned algebra. And so if we want to get into a deeper understanding of the world and see that maybe there's more than just matter in motion, maybe there's something more to life, say, to human beings, than just atoms, well, in order to understand how that can be, maybe we've got to go through that stage the pre-Socratics were in and see, why did they think those things? What's compelling at first? What seems compelling about the idea that everything is just atoms and that's all there is? So if we don't understand why they thought that, it's hard to ever get past that point and say, well, is there something wrong with it? Is there maybe something, a deeper level to reality? And if we don't do that, we're kind of going to be perpetually pre-Socratics and not make an advance. So Aristotle was probably the most famous of the Greek philosophers and perhaps the greatest. And one reason for that is that he was so attentive to what his predecessors said. In most of his works, Aristotle begins by saying, what have the previous thinkers said about this? What can we learn from them? And then can we see where they went wrong? Well, if we never try to learn from them, it's kind of hard to see where they went wrong. So we're not going to make any progress.
Mm-hmm. So. Good. Well, good. Thank you very much.
No problem.
Appreciate it. Great deal. God bless.
Philosopher George Santayana wrote in his book, The Life of Reason, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. That's certainly the case for those who cannot remember or never learned the ideas of the past. New interpretations of Christianity are nearly always unwitting revivals of ancient heresies, and new ways of looking at the nature of reality bring to mind the words of the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes, "There is nothing new under the sun." The ideas propounded by the pre-Socratic philosophers 25 centuries ago are with us still, giving us good reason to take a look at those ideas in their original form. Please join us again next week for the After Dinner Scholar. And as a reminder, visit our webpage and subscribe to the podcast. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.